G'day everyone, this is Tom Uren of Seriously Risky Business, and g'day Grach.
G'day Tom.
First of all, I'd like to thank our founding corporate sponsor Proofpoint, and also thank the cyber initiative at the Hewlett Foundation for their support. So it's been a year since Russia invaded Ukraine, and there's been a lot of reports that have come out since that invasion that have told us something about what's going on there. And we thought we'd just revisit those and talk about whether, air quotes, cyber war has lived up to the expectations. Why don't we start with what did you expect, first of all? Did you have any expectations?
I was certainly expecting more than we saw, but I wasn't expecting the general consensus with the cyber punditry was that there was going to be apocalyptic cyber event, like the banks would go down, there would be, you know, natural gas lines would be exploding, the electricity would just cease to function forever. You know, the worst case Pearl Harbor type things that they love to go on about. And when none of that happened, they went, cyber war is useful because it can do these effects, which are similar to physical attacks. And when that didn't happen, they said, is cyber war even effective at anything, because it couldn't even do physical attacks like we said that it would? And I think that those expectations were misguided, because why would Russia do things that you want them to do? They're going to do things they want to do. So for me, the expectation was that there would be more, but not that it would be, like, I couldn't see them doing the power grid attacks. I couldn't see them doing the destroy the banking. I think everyone at the time expected that they would win the conventional war very quickly and it would become a guerrilla war. And my thinking was actually that it would be the Ukrainians doing those sorts of attacks, like against the banks and against the electricity side. That's sort of more of what I was thinking was going to happen.
Right, sort of the cyber partisan style, like...
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure if I had any expectations. So a while ago, I was involved in writing a paper about Australia's offensive cyber capability.
Uh-huh.
So we talked to people in the military who were talking about their, I guess it was their thought process of how they'd go about it. So that gave me a strong flavor of they recognize that they've got tanks and bullets and shells and stuff like that. And we know that we've got these. We want to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
But I was somewhat flabbergasted that the invasion actually took place.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that I had really strong expectations either way.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we thought going in.
Right.
I remember reading relatively early on about the Viasat thing.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote about it a couple of times. And that seemed to me to be a really good example of how you combine a cyber operation with something that could actually help your troops on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And so that came fairly early on. Maybe I think I'd written about it in the second or third week.
Uh-huh.
I think the first time was, this is an interesting thing that happens to be time coincident. And then the week after that, it was, yes, there's actually evidence that it happened, and it looks like it was a planned operation rather than a coincidence.
So one of the things I want to mention about that is we only know about it because it overflowed from Ukraine, right? Like, Ukraine never reported on it. It was that the German windmills got hit initially, right? They were the ones reporting that there'd been a cyber attack. And then, there was some spillover into, I think, Switzerland and maybe a bit in France as well. But Ukraine didn't announce that this had happened.
Yeah, I think Viasat must have talked about it at some point as well. But I think your point is that if it had been contained on a Ukrainian system, they probably wouldn't have said anything.
Right.
So I guess this gets to the fog of war. So I think we know some things,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
We've had quite a lot of reports. Google came out with one relatively recently. Microsoft has released a couple.
There's a Dutch one which was really good in how it was saying that there's a lot that hasn't been made public, and most of it is espionage.
Yep. And there's been a Ukrainian one. So there's a lot of different threads. And to me, they are they're not all complete, certainly, but the what they're saying is consistent between them, amongst them,
mm-hmm.
for the most part. And to me, they describe, surprisingly, after Viasat, a use of cyber operations in a destructive way, not talking about the espionage uh-huh. part, that is, I don't think, all that effective. They've uh-huh. they've used a kind of offense in depth where cyber operations are one of the mechanisms they're trying to destroy stuff. But there's not a lot of evidence where they've used it in an additive or complementary way where they enhance uh-huh. what they're doing. Is that right. Is that your take as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's worth pointing out that there's a bit of a timeline here as well. I've divided it into four phases. Basically, you've got your invasion phase. That's sort of like that three-day period where obviously everything was very planned out. It was very coherent. It was sort of integrated into an overall strategy. And it made sense in sort of achieving effects that were, you know, additive and also helped the overall plan, like was part of achieving objectives. Then I have what I call the strategic pause, where the week after there's a whole lot of, like, what do you mean the war is still going? Like, we didn't have anything ready for this. Part of what I've been told, and I think is worth keeping in mind, is that during that first week, they burned basically all of the access that they had. They used all of their stuff. It's the one thing that they were doing, and then it was going to be over. So you may as well dump everything.
Yep, yep.
You know, there's no, you don't need to keep reserves.
Big push to victory.
Right, right. And so, after the sort of strategic pause of like, now what do we do? They basically went on this reacquire access.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the thing that they were doing, right? Is that there's some minor attacks here and there, but primarily they were just trying to recover what they'd burned. And then I believe it's around October, we have the war in Donbass phase where it's a fairly stalemate, static fighting, and cyber can't really help in the trenches. You know, like there's not, you can't DDoS the other side. Like DDoS doesn't work for counter battery fire, right? DDoS is not going to push people out of an entrenched protected system. Like it's
right. Yep.
Yeah. It's just, you can't wiper a trench system or like an urban fortress. Those are not things that happen. So there wasn't much it could do. And I think once the counteroffensive phase began, where Russia was also doing these punishing attacks against the electrical grid and against civilian infrastructure, this was a point where cyber could add value again from their perspective. You can't do anything about a trench, but you could probably do something about civilian infrastructure.
Yeah, telcos or...
Right. And so that's when they started doing things again. But as you've pointed out, so yes, there is some degree of coordination, but it's not tightly integrated. And from what I've heard, what I've been told by various people, this is because the cyber units are not tightly integrated into the overall military command that's running the war. Because
yes,
the guys running the war are like, we're doing a war. Like, things blow up,
yep,
people die. Like, this is serious. This is not, yep, computer game stuff. We don't have time to like sit around and chat with nerds in the rear about their computer bullshit. We're fighting a war. So,
yep,
because they're not tightly integrated into that, because they're not part of the team, they can't really do things that would be effects that would help, because,
yep,
they're just not part of that system.
Yeah, yeah, I find that really interesting. Like, the US and Australia have talked a couple of times about trying to integrate effects or cyber operations into kinetic military, where they...
Okay.
Blow stuff up and kill people, and it's difficult. Like they just say it takes too long.
Mm-hmm.
They do stuff that's clever, but I think if you are actually under the pump, you wouldn't wait the 2 weeks to line it up. You'd just fire the missiles in the first place, right?
Yeah,
it's kind of a nice to have.
Exactly.
And so unless you've got a military that's really committed to doing it, like, I'm not sure. Maybe it's just too mm-hmm. hard to do it at the pace a conventional war goes. That's one of the open questions I still have.
Yeah, this is, I think, a very valid question. And I have to admit, I think that cyber falls short on this one because, as we've said a lot of times, cyber is very forward heavy. You know, there's a huge amount of planning and preparation work, and then the execution is seconds.
Yep.
And the military kind of needs that seconds of execution thing but without the 2 weeks preparation.
Yeah.
They need, you know, you've got 3 hours until we go live, so you need to have this ready for tomorrow morning. They don't okay, well, you know, we'll just postpone everything until you guys are ready in your good time, you know?
Yeah, that's
no
right.
rush.
Yeah.
Bombs and bullets are flying, people are dying, but let's wait around for 2 weeks.
Right. Joe Schmo has to, you know, twiddle around on Ida for a little bit because he's a bit confused as to what's happening. So, we'll wait until he's ready.
Yeah. So,
let him have a couple of cigarette breaks and go for coffee, you know? No rush.
I was saying before we started that I'm more confident about having a picture of effects operations, but that there's also a whole lot of cyber espionage that must be going on. And I'm guessing probably has had more of an impact on the war than the effects stuff. Do you agree with that? How much does the fog of cyber war have an influence on what we can say?
At one point, I put together this list of sort of known unknowns.
Known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
Things that we know are going to impact our visibility of the sort of the cyber landscape during this war. So I'll just sort of very quickly go through them. And then we can talk a bit about, you know, cyber and espionage and information operations. So one of them is, like, we're not going to know about any espionage operations that are successful and undiscovered. Right? If no one knows about it, we won't know about it.
So that's espionage rather than effects, though, right? So,
So espionage operations that are effective and are discovered, we're probably not going to know about as well. So that would be if they break into the cyber command headquarters for Ukraine and steal all their stuff, the Ukrainians are not going to come out and be like, they got us good, you know, point to them.
Here's our disclosure, you know, we're all for radical transparency.
You got to hand it to them. They got us good on that
so,
one. Not going to
lie. So what about silent effects operations? Can you imagine an operation that's designed to disrupt that we don't learn about?
Yes, I can, actually. Again, I would say that these would be things that are militarily effective. So if Viasat hadn't overspilled, I don't think the Ukrainians would have ever said, like, yeah, you know, our entire military backbone got shredded.
Probably a really good example is that at the same time they were targeting Viasat, there was a Ukrainian telco that was apparently quite badly affected. But the reporting on that is way less than the Viasat reporting. So Viasat plus the telco plus the invasion is the story. But I tend to forget about the telco stuff.
Right. And so one of the things I've been told about is that the integrated air defense system was severely disrupted.
Right.
Right. So there was attacks against the physical locations, and that wasn't so much of a problem because a lot of that stuff got moved very frequently. So the targeting information there was old. But all of that has to be controlled by computers, and that stuff was effectively targeted. That's my understanding. The thing is, none of this is public, right? And that's because either, you know, it didn't happen, which I think is unlikely, or because it was an effective attack that did severely disrupt military capability, you're not going to say anything about it. That's not something that's going to be part of your...
So there's still stuff that happens in the destructive effects world that we probably don't know about it or is underreported, right?
Right. And I think one of the other things to keep in mind as well is that there'll be things that happen which get a lot of attention. If there's two events that happen at once and one of them is a high profile target and the other one is maybe a much more important but low profile, uninteresting target, like, I don't know, a sugar factory or something, which turns out to be critical for some reason, while at the same time, you know, like the lights in Kyiv go off.
Yep.
We're only going to hear about the big high profile one that's interesting.
Yep, yep. So from where we sit, the sensational hides the impactful sometimes.
Right. Here, I think this is a very important one, given the reporting that comes out. Stuff like the KillNet and HackNet and these harassment campaigns that have no actual impact, no effect, you know, like the DDoS that slowed down city.com for 1 hour at 3 a.m. in the morning on a Sunday because it was announced on Telegram and it gets picked up and they write about, you know, like the Russians are attacking our financial sector, and that gets a lot of attention, but it's meaningless garbage. And I think that reporting Like, it takes up bandwidth that could be used for literally anything. Cat pictures, I think, would be superior.
Yeah.
And I think things that happen that just aren't interesting, but are actually important, like stuff that also happens all the time, but they're acclimated to it. So one of the things that's very, very common out there is these information operations via SMS.
Right.
Take your phone near the front line and you're going to get messages from the other side saying, you know, turn yourself in, or 500 rubles if you shoot your comrades, or, you know, like, you guys are going to lose, or, you know, ha ha ha, your friend has died. These sorts of things. But because they happen so often, and it's just like, if you're there on the front, of course it happens. Like, everyone knows it happens. Like, it's not worth mentioning. It's rain or mud. These things are just there. That stuff doesn't come up because to them it's just normal. To us, it needs to be an aggregate to be interesting.
Right.
You know, like, one SMS to one person is not a news story. You know,
yep.
One
yep,
SMS
yep.
to everyone is.
Right. To me, that'd be interesting if you could say that, you know, those kinds of operations that had impact. And I guess from a news point of view, it's like, how do you know?
Right.
Like, we can see SMSs, but...
Yeah, so there was one early on during the war. I think it was early March. So in the Transcarpathia region, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with. Yeah, it's the region between Hungary and Ukraine. That's the Transcarpathia region, where historically the Hungarians and the Ukrainians, you know, you go back several hundred years, they haven't always been friendly in that region, as one might expect. Now it's a sort of like, there's people that live on both sides of the border that are both ethnicities and both nationalities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. During the early phase of the war, there was a bunch of SMS that went out to Hungarians saying, like, your Ukrainian Nazi neighbors want to kill you and take your land and kick you out. Or basically, they tried to foment antagonism and strife between these two communities. And so the effect that that had was not actual social disruption, but instead the telcos blocked all SMS from Russia.
Yeah.
So it led to a defensive action. And then one of the consequences of that was that they had to move to using GSM boxes, which then put all of their traffic inside of Ukraine, which from an espionage point of view is very useful.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting sort of chain of events there that's ultimately counterproductive, right? I would guess.
So, you know, like, there's things that do happen and they're interesting stories, and they don't show up because it's these, like, little, it's like these little individual nuggets that by themselves, like, they're not relevant. Like, as a narrative, it makes sense, but SMS to the Transcarpathia, like, no one even knows where that is. So,
yeah.
Who cares?
You know? Yeah.
Like, blocking SMS from Russia. Why didn't they do that already?
So, yeah. So, yeah. The other thing is that the most of the reporting I see is biased, I think rightly, in the Ukrainians' favor, mm-hmm. right? Like, so it's very much
absolutely
a unjust invasion. And so everyone uh-huh. is on the Ukrainian side. And so I don't even know if Ukraine is running any sort of destructive cyber operations. And I'm sure that they're running espionage, right? They must be.
Absolutely.
And they must have, I imagine they have allies also helping them. But we hear nothing about that whatsoever. So it's a very one-sided view.
Right. I think there's two sides to keep in mind with that. One is that there's just not a lot of visibility in Russia anyway. Like, overall, you know, I think Microsoft has a much clearer picture of what's going on inside of Ukraine than they do about what's going on inside of Russia. And that's Microsoft with all their telemetry. I think that Kaspersky probably has a really good view of what's going on, but they're not going to publish, here's how Russia is getting its ass kicked in this region. Like, here's a big L that we kind of have to eat.
Yep.
I don't think you could say that legally and be comfortable.
If it's not illegal, it'd be very stupid to say. Regardless. I don't think Kaspersky's stupid, right?
No, absolutely.
I mean, I guess I should caveat by saying that we've heard about DDoS attacks and stuff in Russia, the sort of inconsequential stuff.
I'm going to stop you there for 1 minute, if I may.
Yeah.
I want to bring up this this framework about military cyber that is, it's very useful in terms of thinking about how things can be done and how they interact and so on. So basically, Danny Moore has this framework. I came up with it sort of independently, and someone else has also got the same one. And it I think it's very useful. So you've got this information operations or influence operations, right? There are effects operations, and then there is espionage.
Right. So the destructive stuff falls within effects, but it's not always destructive, right? It's broader than just disruption and...
Exactly.
Yep, okay, yep.
Yeah, it's sort of anything active that changes stuff to cause some effect.
Yeah.
Right. And espionage is basically things that are not active to cause effect, things that sort of just you're collecting, right? So anyway, I think when you're looking at how to integrate cyber into military, you have to think about espionage versus effects.
Yep.
And effects are useful if they can, you know, as we've said, like if they're additive, if they help, if they're part of your overall strategic plan or your tactical plan, and they are complementary in some way, that you can exploit the effects that they create, which needs you to have a plan in the first place. Like you can't...
Yes. a plan and a planning process, which I guess believes in that as an extra option, right?
Right. So here's why I think, for example, that the IT army, like this IT cyber army thing, one of the reasons it's so useless is that they can't do espionage because they cannot be given tasking for security reasons. Like you can't go to them and be like, hey guys, you know, on this public Telegram chat.
Top priority.
Right. We know literally nothing about this. So, you know, anything you could get for us would be great. We're very curious. Yeah. We've got a huge gap.
Right.
And so because they can't be integrated, they can't do this stuff, their effects are useless. They can't be integrated and taken advantage of. And I think the actual Ukrainian cyber people, they understand this, but they also have another thing that they're worried about, which is that Ukraine is very dependent on external support. And so they have to stay within the moral boundaries and norms of Western liberal democracies.
Yep.
You know, like even if they could go and just start shutting down hospitals in Russia as a, you know, screw you guys, we're going to make life painful for your needy and vulnerable. They wouldn't do that because it would look very, very bad.
Yeah. They can't paint themselves as the villain.
There are... Like they have to be very restrained in, they need to be on the moral high road. Like,
yep.
And I think that's going to have an impact in that there are effects operations they could do, and that, you know, some cyber pundits would be wondering, why don't they do this? And it's, they don't want to violate the norms that we would sort of agree exist, like you don't attack civilian infrastructure.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a good example of actually the planning process. I mean, the ultimate goal is to, I guess it is to win, right, against Russia.
Uh-huh.
And the way you get that is by having foreign support. And the way you keep that is not by running stupid effects operation that allow you to be painted as the villain.
Absolutely. So I think that's worth keeping in mind. So they've got a strong incentive only to do espionage and to limit their effects. I mean, for example, if they were doing effects that I could see them doing are when they're doing these drone attacks deep into Russia, they might do effects operations against radars along the way to limit visibility. I don't think they need to, and I don't think that that's happened, but that's...
Yeah, that would make sense, right?
That's the sort of thing that they could do, right? Completely in line with what we would expect. And so, yeah, like I think they're primarily focused on espionage stuff, and I think that they probably have to do a huge amount of deconflicting with, you know, NSA and, you know, everyone else, because I mean, I can't imagine that there's a Russian network that hasn't been penetrated by at least one NATO member at this point. You know?
Yeah. So my takeaway from what we've just talked about is we've got some idea, I think, of what's going on when it comes to effects. It's not perfect. When it comes to espionage, very little idea, but it's kind of... fine.
The point.
So the reason that to me is less interesting is because we know espionage is a thing that is worthwhile, right? So countries doing espionage is not an unresolved question, whereas countries using effects operations in war is a new thing where we expect to learn more, right? Right. And so,
well, as you're saying as well, it's about uncertainty, and like there is no uncertainty that there's espionage. Like that's a certainty.
Yep.
You know it's happening.
Yep. And the question is, how much is it influencing the war? We don't know. And
right.
So to me, that means that there's not a lot for me to actually talk about because I don't know. I expect it's having a huge impact.
Like the really, really interesting thing about intelligence is how well is it used? And that's got nothing to do with what we know about or whatever. So there's stuff like a lot of the times when you give like foreign intelligence estimates or whatever to policymakers, if it doesn't agree with their pre-existing notions, they'll just go, these guys are wrong. Like, how could the intelligence estimate get this so wrong? Like, I was there for 2 weekends, you know, in my gap year, and I know exactly the nature of these people. So I disagree with this completely. You know, that's interesting, but that's not an issue here.
I guess in terms of this particular war, there's tactical intelligence about where forces are and where tanks are. Like, it's possible to see that cyber espionage would help you there, but it seems like that app you were talking about where the populace reports troop locations would actually be more useful than the actual espionage part, right? Possible if the Russians had a really good integrated battlefield picture that was networked, that would be a great place to compromise. It just doesn't seem like the way they've behaved that actually exists. I mean, maybe it does. Yeah, right. I don't know.
Runs on damp string, tin cans, and 2 potatoes.
Yeah. And because I don't know whether it exists, so like, oh, well, what can I say? But I guess the next question is, what do you think this invasion and what we've learnt tells us about cyber, you know, air quotes, cyber war in general? I guess the naive view would be, look at what the Russians have achieved in terms of effects. I think it's underwhelming. And therefore, the straight line is, cyber effects are useless in war. Let's just dump the idea and move on.
Yeah, exactly. It's cyber has proven itself conclusively to be a waste of time. We should all just disband. It's over.
Yeah, that's right. It's never going to be used again.
Yeah. You know, we tried that. It didn't work. Moving on. I think it's worth keeping in mind that every war is different. And that's very much true for cyber because so much of the possibility of effects is based on the level of penetration of cyber into everyday life on the target side.
Right, yep.
Right, so it doesn't really matter how good you are if, you know, you're trying to bomb them back into the Stone Age and they're in the Stone Age.
Yep.
Doesn't, like, it's meaningless. So, I think we need to sort of keep that in mind, that Ukraine has got a certain level of development. They also have a certain number of constraints in terms of, as we were just talking about, they can't do things to Russia that they will not do things that they could do simply because for strategic reasons, it's a bad idea.
Yep.
Not necessarily because tactically it's a bad idea or because, you know.
Or they couldn't technically or.
Right. You know, all sorts of things like that. There might be something that would be useful to them. But they don't want to do it because it's going to make them look bad, so they don't. They're willing to accept it. I think we need to keep that in mind that the Russians, for example, they have not gone after the alliance. All right. So there's this sort of international alliance of people who, or a coalition, I'm pretty sure we want to be called the allies. But there's things that could happen, right? Like if the ransomware crews were told, hey, the Netherlands is seriously pissing us off. It would be great if Rotterdam port just stopped for a while. Go nuts. And they could impose costs on Europe, for example, with cyber. And they could do it in a way that would be implausibly deniable.
Uh-huh.
And they haven't. Like, the Russians haven't done that. I don't really know why, but a lot of people have been expecting this to happen. It hasn't happened. Is it because they've evaluated, they've looked at it, they've done the planning, they've come out and they said, you know, it's not worth it. Like, the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
Yep.
You know, but have they just not thought of it? Have they asked? People told them, you know, go pound sand. We're not doing what you want. Who knows? I mean, I personally think that they haven't really thought about it because they're in the middle of a war. And they're not thinking about, you know, raising the cost of tea by, you know, 2 cents across Europe as like a punishment thing. Like, it just, I don't think that that's part of their worldview necessarily.
So
we're not getting a sort of total view of all possibilities of what could happen and then seeing their impacts. Similarly, you know, as we've talked about many times, the West doesn't have the same doctrine of cyber that Russia does. So it's the way that Russia's using cyber is not necessarily reflective of the way that the West would try and use it. So if we sort of switch to the other way around, you know, if the West was on the offense, would they do the same things, or would they have the same relaxed attitude to like letting the cyber guys just sort of do what they feel?
Look, just thinking about it, I wouldn't be surprised if it was somewhat similar to what we saw here, in that there's orchestrated, planned stuff right at the beginning. And because you've got a theory of how you're going to win and you can figure out a way for it to take advantage. And then I wouldn't be surprised if that disappears after the first phase.
Yeah, after the plan meets the enemy.
First couple of weeks or whatever.
It's that thing that we've talked about as well. So, you know, before the attack, you've got sort of all of this planning and preparation time so you can get ready for something. And then sort of once it starts, the time pressure shifts completely and you can't really take that, you know, 1 month
You're South African, so you would know the idea of set pieces in rugby, where you've got a kind of formation that you know the starting position, and so you can plan what you're going to do. And then very quickly that breaks down because after, you know, 10 seconds of rugby, it's just a melee. That's kind of my seat of the pants conception, that for any conflict you expect, you probably have plans for the first, I mean, this is what militaries do, they have plans, right? And so you have, probably have plans that you can, as they get closer, pull off the shelf and polish up and have cyber involved.
Right.
But then as the possibilities branch out, it becomes very hard to cover all possibilities.
Yeah, there's that quote, I believe it's Eisenhower, with plans are useless, but planning is invaluable.
Yeah. I don't know if it's Eisenhower, but I like that quote as well.
Right. And I think the problem for cyber here is that planning in and of itself is not necessarily useful because you need to do this. Well, you know, like hypothetically, we could do this, you know, okay, but you still need to put the time into the actual research and preparation part, which when you get a tank from the factory, you don't then have to go and reconfigure it completely for this one specific thing that it needs to do. And then it ceases to be useful ever again because you've used it that one time.
That's it.
We've learned a lot about resilience as well, I think. And it's, I think it's worth bringing that up because a lot of the talk about effects seems to go like, you know, and then we turn the lights off and they collapse, you know, like they just fall over and lie on their backs like turtles going like, oh my God, the lights are off. That's it. You know, we can't do anything anymore. We're done. The amount of resilience is that, you know, once you've turned the lights off, people get to work on putting them back on again. We've mentioned those telco engineers that are living and dying to keep people on the networks. And that is part of the resilience that is worth keeping in mind. So like, yes, you can do an effects operation, but it's only going to last for so long until it gets reverted. And the next time you do it, that psychological impact is not going to be there. So, you know, the first time that you take over someone's CCTV cameras and on all the screens, you put up, I don't know, laughing emojis or like the anonymous thing, that's probably very distressing. The fifth time, it's like, call Rob and have him reboot the router, they're at it again.
Yeah, so that's another argument that downplays the value of effects and destructive cyber operations, right?
Yeah.
But do you think that they're totally useless? Or do you think that they've got their place still?
I think they have their place where, personally, in my opinion, I don't think that they are true cyber, right? Like, if this was like Kung Fu would be like, okay, you've learned like the forms, but you haven't learned the heart of the matter. The real value of cyber is not in deny, disrupt, destroy sort of things. It's using cyber against larger systems. So where cyber is something that gives you access to a broader system. So for example, when there's the attack against the Yandex taxi in Moscow, where basically they sent all of the taxis to pick up people in one location. And the thing that was being attacked there was not the taxi allocation system. It was not the computers inside that. It was the overall system of routing taxis. That was the system that was being attacked. So the cyber was being used to target this broader system that then caused a traffic jam, which was the other system that was being attacked. So I think that that's the value that cyber has, is using it to access other systems, not to do these smaller things. And I'm not sure that you can use those in a military context as rapidly. I think it's complicated, and I don't know if it's easily transferable, but that's where I think cyber is really, really good. I think that that's worth exploring.
Yep. So I occasionally get asked about Australia spending a huge amount on nuclear submarines. They're nuclear now. They used to just be conventional submarines, but in the time that I've been asked, they now become nuclear submarines. And people will often ask, shouldn't we just be spending that money on cyber capabilities? And I'm afraid I just have to tell them, no, I'm afraid not. They're not the same thing. We don't get what we get out of submarines, out of having, you know, more people in ASD or wherever. So unfortunately, that's still true.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I think people get wrong about cyber is thinking that it replaces conventional stuff, and it doesn't. It's added. It's complementary. You still need all of the conventional stuff, but now you also need cyber. It's not a replacement. You can't be like, well, we don't need tanks anymore. We've got Phil. He's got a laptop. We're good. We can disband the tank corps. It doesn't work like that. But you can't get rid of Phil either. You still need him and his laptop and the tanks.
That's right. You've got to buy tanks and laptops now. So we've gone from, I guess, in the Gartner hype cycle, we've gone from the peak of overinflated expectations, and now we're in the trough of despair. We don't think we should write it off entirely, but it's not all that it has been cracked up to be. So thanks a lot, Gruff.
Good talking to you. See you again, Tom.